Way back, it's not on my CV. I got my start doing this. I worked at a radio station, and part of the radio station was connected to a TV station, and I was the overnight producer. So I did some really weird talk shows. And when not doing the, I mean, like the one's called Coast to Coast, with like they talk about alien possessions and ghosts, and it's basically radio for stoners. But they also, I produced all the audio segments, the recorded audio segments for the morning drive show. So the meteorologist from TV would come in and record like a lot of the different weather drops for the next day. And I would have to edit out all the ums and the breaths and the fucks and the damn it's. And I hadn't thought about it in a long time. I actually burned a CD just for myself of all these outtakes. And then the meteorologist that I worked with for so many years, he kind of had this rough go of things. Like he got let go from the station for something else unrelated, and he got hired by another station. Then he was reporting on a tornado or something like that, like where they break into everyday programming, and he had to break in on The Bachelor,
Oh my God.
and he was getting live tweets from viewers who were pissed off that the local weatherman had to stop The Bachelor to report that people's houses are getting destroyed by a tornado. And
Oh
they're
no.
like dogging him out on live tweeting this thing. And he flipped out and started cussing out the audience on camera. And he's like, "God damn it, people." And the reason I know this is somebody sent me a YouTube video of it. So like he's a YouTube star of getting it. And I'm like, and I so I sent that video. I'm like, I know him. And I went and I dug out the old CD of all of the edits that I pulled out.
You're like, these curses sound familiar.
We're connected on LinkedIn still, of course, and I don't know what's appropriate. Like, hey man, how you doing? Heard you flipped out on live television.
Yeah, hope all is well in the sense that I know the internet's after you at the moment. Hey everyone, welcome to Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort. Without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. I am so excited to chat with today's friend of the podcast. He has made a career in the live music arena as a front of house engineer, production manager, and tour manager. And it's fair to say he has probably engineered some of my favorite concerts over the past couple years, and he makes the country and rock heavy hitters sound great day in, day out, from the likes of Godsmack, Avatar, Saint Asonia, Avenged Sevenfold, Hunter Hayes, just to name a few. He's been featured in Pro Sound News, Audio Technical, Mixed Magazine, Roadie Free Radio, Mixmaster's inaugural episode, you get it. So without further ado, please welcome the man making your favorite rock stars sound like they aren't terrible, the founder of Hello, the ultimate all-inclusive live concert video production service, Eric Rogers.
That's the best intro I've ever heard. Thank you.
My pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time. Quite a different world going from radio edits for the meteorologist to literally some of the biggest rock and roll acts in the game.
Is this a family podcast, or if I let something fly, is that okay?
Oh, it's all good.
I mean, I'm not coming out here like Andrew Dice Clay or anything like that. Because I mean, we have to censor ourselves in certain situations, but
right.
Just imagine you're in a scenario where you see like a life-altering, dangerous event, right? Like you're at a baseball game and a meteor hits the ballpark. What are you, the average man in America, going to exclaim? Oh no, Harold, this looks dangerous. Are you going to be just like, holy fucking, and just flip out? And when I see us censoring our media in that regard, like I totally understand censoring for content and just over the top, just offensiveness. I get that, because some things are just tasteless. But when you censor out the emotion from something, it takes away from it. I'm not saying that they should go out there and be all talking like a sailor, but I think if we let the people we look at on media actually have the same emotions and reactions that we have, it might be more genuine.
Have you seen that happen with like acts? And we don't have to like name any acts or anything like that, but that do try to censor maybe on stage personas and whatnot just to appeal to a broader audience?
Oh, that is 100% country music in my experience. You want to present this wholesome front, right? You're selling yourself as wholesome. So you're not saying anything, you're not hitting the seven dirty words. You're not overtly talking. We've gone to talking about sex the kind of the same way the Beatles did.
Right.
Except, you know, instead of saying, I want to hold your hand, it's something about, you know, I got the good stuff. Let's go down by the river. And, you know, we all know what happens down by the river.
Right.
You're not talking about it out overtly. But when I've noticed in the country shows, the audience, there's families there, people bring their kids. The audience is still getting drunk. So it's not as wholesome as Nashville wants you to believe that it is. But at the same time, there's never the blue, black, and white sticker on their records. It can be played anywhere. And their whole thing is radio, radio, radio. And you still can't say things on the radio. So in order to be a successful country music star, you need to be friendly to radio. Versus rock and roll, it's kind of funny. Rock and roll is friendly radio, but equally there's like the internet stuff, the streaming. And then there's just those bands that you see that you don't really know why you know their name, because you've never heard their shit, but you know their name because you see them at every festival.
Right. Yeah.
And they're a little more free to say whatever they want because they know that that's their thing. It's like they're entertaining, you know, 50,000 drunks at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I know the answer, but hey, have you had the opportunity to do some of those like larger rock festivals by chance?
Tons.
Do you have like a favorite that stands out?
My favorite rock festival. Let me think. It would probably be Hellfest in France.
Oh yeah.
It's funny. Like I've done Hellfest now. I did it 2018 with a band called Sons of Apollo. We did it 2019 with Godsmack. And I'm going next year, 2022, with Avatar. It's one of the most well-produced orchestrated festivals. There are a ton of artists, and it operates like a machine. The fan, there's, like, I don't know how many stages there are. I mean, there's two main stages. They're side by side, but there's like five or six auxiliary stages somewhere. And I mean, we're talking 100-some thousand people that everybody's comfortable. I mean, I've walked around the crowd. It's comfortable. It's not crammed together. It's not dangerous. There's enough food and water and bathrooms for everybody. The production for us is outstanding. And the artist catering is beyond amazing. It's like on the third story of this temporary structure they build that overlooks the stages. So like we actually, you know, we get a chef made gourmet meal plus a balcony seat and a tablecloth. While we're you get a meal and a tablecloth while you're watching Megadeth play. Pretty awesome.
That's wild. Every summer, I would get so excited for the Hellfest videos, the Rockam Ring, and that was always my like favorite time of year, internet wise, was all those shows getting streamed out.
There's another one called Music Fest. Music Fest. It's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We just did it with Godsmack in 2019. A great. If you look up Godsmack Bethlehem on YouTube, there's a very dedicated fan cam who picked up the entire 90-minute show.
Wow.
And it was pretty stoked. It was dope. I like
it. Is wild how great some fan cams are.
And they got away with it without us knowing. Yeah, like good on you.
Yeah.
I never get upset when I see it. Like when you come, if somebody were to come up to me, and I've had this happen at festivals before, like, hey man, can I get an audio feed from your console? I'm like, oh.
You're like, I'm not risking you ruining the show.
But at the same time, if somebody's sneaky enough to get a microphone up or something like that, and it looks good and it sounds good, you're like, good on you, dude.
Yeah.
you won this round. I'm happy for them. And I know that music festivals started with bands like the Grateful Dead and like a sea of tapers in the audience. So it's not like I'm gonna shut down it's like an institution now.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that. Is that pretty frequent that people try to hook up to the soundboard?
No, it's really at more the hippie bands, the jam bands, because their fans are used to the tapers of Grateful Dead. And quite honestly, if you know, probably imbibed a few things by the time our show starts and you're going to walk up, you might have a little courage in you to ask. But yeah, nobody, most stuff I get asked, people ask for set lists and picks and drumsticks, stuff like that.
If you don't mind me asking, I know we kind of talked about the beginning, not how you were starting off at a radio station. How did you make that transition into the live music realm? Was that always intentional?
Well, no, it was parallel. I'd been working with a local band in Ohio for a few years, but I was that 20-year-old kid who was driving the truck and unloading the gear and getting paid $50 and all the beer I could drink. So I took the job at the radio station because it seemed interesting. A $12 an hour, learn how to use the board at a radio station job, but I had already been mixing bands by then. So it turns out that the program manager of that station played in a local band. So when he saw whatever made up audio talent I put on this resume to get a job interview, he liked it. And he had a conversation kind of like this and ended up getting a job. Wow, that was 22 years ago. Dear God.
So did that just kind of like escalate then into some of these other opportunities that bands kept moving? Or
I started working around Dayton, Ohio, and I, you know, like mixed one band exclusively, then other bands would come and evidently I was getting good at what I was doing, and other bands would hear it, and then I was getting offers like, hey man, if you're not doing anything this weekend, can you come do our band? Sure. And at the time I still didn't know that there was a such thing as a touring audio engineer. I for real thought that like every band would go to every city and there was like a guy, and that guy did. So there was this arena that I loved in Ohio called Hara Arena, H-A-R-A, and it's gone now. A tornado destroyed it a few years ago. It was a shithole before the tornado destroyed it. The tornado did it a favor. But I started going to shows there when I was like 15, 16. I mean, I saw probably, I lost count, so many Pantera shows, Megadeth shows. Anytime there was a rock show coming to this thing, I went there and I saw the show. And I thought that there was a guy who worked for like a local company that, Hair Arena, like, hey, we've got, you know, so-and-so, we've got Rob Zombie tonight. So we need a guy. And so I started looking for local sound companies because I wanted to be that guy. So I figured I would learn how to do that. And then, you know, we get called to bring in sound to some show. And like, wait a minute, like the band has a guy tours with the band. I blew my mind. I didn't know. And that became my, like, I want to learn more. I want to do more so I can be that guy.
So did you start with like local bands then and just offer that up? Or what did that journey look like getting to actual tours?
I started with local bands. I started off, you know, loading and unloading their gear, mm-hmm. and doing lights. And it's really funny because I'm colorblind.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see the world in black and white, but I'm definitely colorblind. I would make things blink. And I'm not a lighting guy, which is funny because, you know, as my tour advanced, I don't know what they're doing with the lights, but I would make them. I had a foot controller that I used with my hands to bump and flash these incandescent analog lighting fixtures in time, because I mean, I'm colorblind, but I can count to four. And I had that going for me. And then the band was actually the guitar player. He's still a very good friend of mine. He's notoriously cheap, and they got sick and tired of paying the local sound company like $300 a show to mix the band. So he went and bought a PA system, and they're like, well, who's going to mix it? And they're like, Eric can mix it. And I'm like, Eric can do what? And he showed me like three different things on the console and a couple things in a rack. And he's like, figure it out, dude. Okay. And that's how it got started. Then there's like another band in town, and a friend of mine was their audio guy, and he had a job at a local sound company. And he's like, well, you should come work for us. Like, what do you do? And it turns out I got a job for $12 an hour, like sweeping the floor and soldering cables.
Right on.
And that's how it started. It went from bar bands to, oh wow, there's a company that does this, to having a job as like the catch-all guy. And then I would stay after. I did a lot of grunt work during the day, and then I would stay after hours and just learn. Like, he would, the owner of that company, his name was Paul McDermott. He let me take any piece of gear home or stay late, plug stuff in, turn up, use whatever I wanted, just get better at what I was doing.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, I literally got paid to be a mad scientist and just experiment on shit.
When you were toying around, did that influence how you operate today?
I think it plays into it a lot. That's a really, nobody's asked me that question before. I think that, like, as everybody develops a style or I don't want to say a signature, but it's actually there. It's actually real. It's a signature. Like, you have some people that are trained, especially now. There are schools that you can go to, audio engineering school, and you can tell that their approach is a little more, I would say, clinical or textbook. I mean, this was in the late night for me. It was in the late 90s, early 2000s, and we were providing sound for everything from a rave to a gospel revival to somebody's graduation, whatever. And it was more guerrilla style. You know, we didn't have the best high-end gear. You had to make stuff work with what we had, instead of buying a new piece of gear that would actually, you know, a new digital EQ or something like that. We were actually going back to using the laws of physics and properly splaying the boxes, properly laying out the boxes, you know, using properly gain matching amplifiers, stuff like that. So to give us the advantage and learning, well, I mean, he knew, I learned along the way, like, how things work and why things work and why things put together. So it gave me more of a bilateral approach, where, like, during the day when the lights are on in the arena, everything I do has a scientific purpose to it. There's a calculable, mathematical, tangible reason for doing everything. There's the scientific approach to build it, from things like microphone placement, microphone selection, gear placements, all that stuff. But then when the lights turn off, then that's the other one where it's not an experiment. We go through a boatload of rehearsals, but it's a very artistic kind of creative flow where there's a source of music, there's a medium to transmit that music, and it's my job to translate that. And that comes from me thinking everything in my head, where it's not a mathematical thing. And I think I only got that by being able to do my thing in the basement of a warehouse, like, just 11:30 p.m. no one's around, let's get as loud as we can and start messing, shape things and make things sound the way I want them to sound. There was never a dotted line to guide me from A to B. It was like, I'm gonna put these three things in a chain and figure out what they do together.
And you mentioned that was like a basement warehouse.
Yes.
Did that help then? I'm picturing like concrete walls kind of thing, where there's a whole lot of stuff you got to deal with. Did that help as well?
Yeah. Okay. So one of the earliest lessons I had is, he took a monitor wedge, a microphone, just an SM58 Shure, very standard vocal microphone, a console, and an EQ. And the ceiling was maybe an 8-foot ceiling, if that. And it was concrete, all four walls. And he was like, get it loud, and walked away. And I would be like, check one, two. And I would be turning things, and it would be feeding back. And then I would notch that frequency out of the EQ. And I would keep doing this. And I thought I got it really loud, and it's not feeding back. And the EQ looked like a jack-o'-lantern. There were just notches everywhere. And he comes, this was maybe 20 minutes. I mean, I was really slow. I thought I was being methodical and thoughtful about it. Like, get as loud as I can. When that frequency starts feeding back, pull it down, move on to the next. And he comes in, he's like, you think that's loud? And he flattened out the EQ, and then actually used proper gain staging, where he got it up to, got it to the brink of feedback before we started EQing things. Walked away from it, and he's like, check. And my hair stood up. I'm like, holy crap, dude, this is so loud. And then he pushed it a little more to make it feedback. He's like, just one little notch. It's like, that's all you'll ever need.
Wow.
And it was little lessons like that. And then he would walk away. He would just, you know, pat me on the back, laugh, you know, go get me a soda or whatever. It was funny. But at the same time, it was, being in that cramped, shitty little reflective room, and being able to, because he cut his teeth on like all these old basement punk rock shows in the 80s. So he's like, I'm learning like trench warfare tricks from a veteran. So from the 80s to the 90s, there was a lot of technology advances. So I didn't have to deal with that. But some of my training came from some of these wonderful engineers, amazing guys who didn't have nearly the fancy tool belt that I have.
Yeah, that's awesome. I hadn't even thought about that, trying to do like those punk shows, because that was so just DIY off the grid at that time. And then, I mean, venues not unlike what you're describing.
Yeah.
But did that lend itself then to kind of these hard rock, heavy metals? Was that always what you grew up on, and or what led you there?
It's what I grew up listening to. And it's what I like. But when the bar band that I worked for, they were party band. They were cover band. Like they still exist. They still play the same 90s rock stuff for the same 90s rock moms. They're just my age now.
Yeah.
So it's not like anybody's going out to the bar to see Slayer. So that wasn't where I got into it. So when I went to go work for the company, a lot of our clients were not the party band. We did raves, a lot of electronic music. We did a handful of metal shows. Like if a metal show came to town, we did it. A handful of punk shows, but that scene had already died. And we did a lot of, like, we did folk music and a lot of like the African-American church. So we did a lot of gospel, a lot of funk bands. I really cut my teeth mixing stuff that's, I would say, a lot more musical than metal. A little more dynamic. And then you get into metal. So that's where you learn tone and finesse. And then you get, you know, the local metal band. And they're not the super talented metal band like Avenged Sevenfold or Godsmack or any of like my more recent clients. They're just a laser beam turned up as loud as it can go. And now you're in audio janitorial mode.
Yeah.
So I learned both. I learned the finesse and I learned the damage control.
Did you have it where local bands were just like mind blown with how great you could make them sound, or did they not realize how awful their inputs were? And
no, I was getting the compliments. It was, nice. It was like, and it would be little things like, why do they sound like a big arena band? And it was, it's not even unconventional to me. It's like really obvious stuff. Little things that I'll tell people this to this day. Like if it's on the stage and making noise, it needs to have a microphone on it. Like why would I ever, and this was the thing, like you've seen these punk shows and these bars that they like, there's like a mic in the kick drum and a vocal mic and that's it, because everything else like those, I'm like, no, like that everything needs to be coming out of the PA. So the first thing we need to do is get your stage volume down a little bit. And we need to get the PA up. Like, and the PA system in a bar show needs to be as loud as you can get it, and the bartenders can still hear their orders. And then we started doing things like if the band was set up in the stage over here, we would aim the PA this way away from the bar. So even if, you know, if just 1-2 degrees, just getting that point where like the bartenders can hear the people ordering drinks and the people in the line of fire of the PA system feel like they're at a big rock show, that's winning. Because then there's a microphone on everything. There's that relationship of kick, snare, and hat is now in that PA system. Like it's a band. It's sounding like that instead of just some guy standing in the basement. And that was and the other thing I did was I approached every show like, I approached every show like James Hetfield was going to walk in that room and hire me.
Yeah.
He never did.
Right.
He never did. But, you know, I did that. I was like, so you never know. And I approach it to this day. You never know who's around. I haven't really solicited for a job in years.
So you're working for this company. Is that what led to some of these larger acts was moving on up? The company itself got hired or?
No, I worked for that company for a few years. And then I got another company, like another regional company, got a little regional tour and hired me. So I got my first taste of that like, ooh, this is pretty cool. And I knew that my company was not ever going to be a touring company. And I knew the company that I had gone out with was never going to be like at the level that I want to be. So I got all the industry magazines and I learned what companies did that. And I made another really good looking resume with whatever limited experience I have. And I sent it everywhere. And the only company to answer was Thunder Audio out of Detroit, who actually conveniently was also at the time, they were the audio provider for Metallica.
Oh, you got really close.
I ended up going out with Metallica in 2010, working for the company.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Not for Metallica, but I did go out with them working for the company. Uh-huh. But I drove 4 hours for a 5-minute job interview where he's like, yeah, sure, we'll put you on a gig. We'll see how you do.
Wow.
And my first two gigs were Bonnaroo and something for the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City on this big outdoor show.
Wow.
And it just kind of grew from there. Like, it was like, oh, we're going to send you out on tour. Like, who with? And it's like, oh, we're going to send you out with Deep Purple. Okay, meet. And eventually that led to, we're going to send you out with Avenged Sevenfold. And what I was doing, I wasn't mixing the band. I was setting up the sound system. And I had grown from setting up the sound system to being the engineer in charge of the sound system, designing the sound system. And then while I was out with Avenged, there were a couple circumstances where I ended up filling in mixing because their engineer, who's a friend of mine named Nigel, he needed to step out. He's like, can you cover for me? Sure. And then at a certain point, the Avenged was like, do you want to come work for us?
Nice. Wow.
So I go back to my boss at Thunder. I'm like, hey, thanks for the opportunity. This is great. This is where I want to be. And because I was a contractor for the company, I wasn't like an employee. Like, hey, I'm going to stick or I'm going to do these shows with Avenged. And then I had this relationship where I used to work for the vendor and now I work for the band, but now I'm staying loyal to the vendor. And so there were a few years where I would do like a lot of work for Thunder Audio as the vendor, but then I had other tours that, you know, from that that Avenged Sevenfold thing that led to other, like a band called Apocalyptica, for example. And I would do those the Apocalyptica shows, and then in between those tour legs, and Thunder would send me out on, you know, Deep Purple or Rod Stewart or whatever. They would send me out on something else, and it was kind of this balancing thing until eventually one day my touring schedule working for the artist kind of overtook the company stuff. And I mean, there's probably 10 years ago, I stopped taking company gigs. Not that I'm unfriendly to the company or anything like that. It's just, it's one of those natural progressions.
In demand. Well, that's very cool. I guess for folks that maybe haven't had that step up, what's the biggest difference or the most important maybe piece of information approach between, say, like that bar club level gig and then going to like arena or an outdoor?
This is one of those topics that everybody's going to have a different answer to and everybody's going to think everybody's wrong.
Which makes it fun.
Yeah, it makes it fun. So like, I know my answer, like I'm going to get the commentary like, that's bullshit. But to me, there's no difference between playing Wembley Stadium and playing the Mug and Jug downtown. Like, at the end of the day, it is still your show. Like, your job is to take that source material that you have through the medium you have available and into the ears of your audience at the best way possible. You might not have the tools that you have and the awesome medium that you have at the stadium in the bar, but don't look at it as a little gig. Don't look at it as a stepping stone gig. I mean, it is a stepping stone gig. It really is. I mean, I don't want to go back and do another fucking bar show.
Right.
But the truth is if you approach everything like that, like you're mixing the most important show of your life, like you're doing the most important gig you could ever be doing, there's no difference because the laws of physics don't change just because there's not a bar. The laws of physics don't change just because you have more microphones or better microphones. Just use the laws of the universe to your advantage.
Quick detour. When you started going on the road and with Avenged, was that like 2009-ish?
That was nine. Yeah. Oh, nine. I had done a couple tours earlier than that, but Avenged was like my first taste of like what I really wanted to be doing.
I went to that tour.
Avenged and Buck Cherry?
Yeah, so I was there for that show in Tacoma Dome.
It was Avenged, Buck Cherry, and Papa Roach.
Yeah, and then like Saving Abel played like 2-3 songs.
And Saving Abel, yes.
Yeah, oh gosh. It's wild to believe that was 12 years ago.
And actually, I remember that show because I had woken up. Our bus was blue. This is actually a testament to how good our bus driver was, because I woke up and I get out and you're kind of staggering out. This is in the morning and I want to go find a dressing room, and I get up early so I can take a shower. Like most of the time you shower after the show. I'm like, I'm a morning shower guy. So I'll get up way early and shower in the production office. And I look at I get off the bus and the door is kind of stuck open. And I have to shove it open. And our driver was like, oh yeah, careful with that. Like, what the hell happened? And I look and the mirror is smashed. The headlight is smashed. And there's fur and blood down the side of the bus.
Oh, no.
And he's like, yeah, deer jumped out at us. And give you an idea of how much a tour bus weighs. We didn't feel it.
Oh no.
And he didn't stop.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, and you've seen it. I mean, you've seen what happens when a deer crosses the path of a Prius.
Yeah, it destroys the thing.
And yeah, we did. I mean, none of us felt it. There were 12 of us on this bus and it was like nothing. So, and I remember that because it was outside the Tacoma Dome. Like, huh,
jeez.
I should be grateful right now.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, because especially one of those things gets thrown off, and that's a very different story.
You know, it's weird. We've had 18 months off. There hasn't been tours. So that means there's been 18 months that I haven't heard of a friend in some awful accident, but it seems like they've been happening lately. And lately as in, you know, 2019, 18, whatever. And it's in the back of my head as all my friends and colleagues are going back on to buses. It's like, while we're talking about masks and all the other safety thing, you know, masks and gun laws and all the other things that we have to worry about in the, you know, the news talking about what happens at rock shows, like in the back of my head, like slow the buses down and keep your driver awake, bring him a cup of coffee. Don't overroute him because crashes happen too. Like while we're focused on the hot button topics, I still don't want to see people crash.
Our bodies aren't used to it. 18 months out of that, haven't had to stay up all night driving 600 miles. How does that, you know, work for you? Like you're on the road and whatnot. How important is like a steady schedule for yourself?
Well, fortunately, when I'm not touring, I have a daughter in school. So I come back home to Florida. And like, cause when I'm gone, she lives with her mom. So, and I'm like, her mom is this awesome woman who basically takes most of her life and dedicates it to raising our daughter. And then I swoop in for a couple weeks here and there and whatever, you know, it's like I'll tell the world I'm super dad, but she's really super mom.
Shouts out to her.
But the thing is school bus comes early and she's 13 years old. It's not like she's waking up on her own.
Yeah.
The school bus comes at like 7:50 a.m., but she got sent to bed at 9, but I think she shut off TikTok at 2:30.
Yeah.
So she's, you know, you get up early and you get the kid. And then when I go to work, I'm also the tour manager a lot of the time. So I've got to be the first guy in to meet with the locals. So I'm already used to that old man getting up with the sun schedule.
Gotcha.
It's the difference is like right now I'll go to bed at 11 PM. I'm not at work on tour. I don't get to go to bed until 2. So that 4 hours of sleep versus 8 hours of sleep is pretty dark.
For those who aren't familiar, what is a tour manager? And you do tour management, production management, and front of house engineering. So would you mind, I guess, breaking those latter two down, what that means? And then also, how do you manage all that when you're doing that on the road?
We'll start with the front of house engineer. The front of house audio engineer is the guy. If you're not familiar with this business and what it is, but you've been to a concert, imagine yourself, you're at the show, you see the big bullpen in the middle of the floor with all the consoles and electronics. I'm the guy standing in there doing everything in my power to make sure that the music coming out of the speakers is the exact same thing as the music coming out of the instruments. That's a nice way of saying I'm making your favorite band sound like they don't suck.
Yeah.
But The production manager is the person who's in charge and oversees all elements of the actual production of the show. You're not supposed to use the same word to define something that you're defining. And the production of the show would be everything from the audio to the lighting to the video system to the riggers. The riggers are the people that are fearless and they climb hundreds of feet in the air into arena ceiling and drop chains and motors to pick up all this heavy stuff, overseeing all the pyro guys and all the effects, all the elements that actually go into making a show. The production manager's job is to oversee all that and to delegate the responsibilities accordingly. The tour manager is the person who's in charge of the successful completion of a gig, of a day. He oversees the day-to-day operations of the entire tour. So they'll delegate that response, like the production responsibility, to the production manager. A stage manager is in charge of making sure everybody gets on and off on time. And really, a stage manager never cares when you start. He only cares when you stop. And, you know, and the tour manager, they're in charge of hiring the crew. They're in charge of solving any weird drama. They're in charge of making sure everybody has the money in their hotel rooms and making sure all the buses and trucks go the right direction, resolving conflicts and dealing with a lot of band. But while the production manager and the stage manager are in the venue handling all the elements of the show, the tour manager might be with the band doing radio station interviews or leading them from one podcast to the next or whatever, doing meet and greets and public appearances and stuff like that.
For sure. And that, I imagine, I guess, how has that been for you managing all that at various scales? Because, I mean, obviously you work with some like the biggest names in like rock and roll. So how did you jump into that side of things? I know a lot of what we've talked about thus far is front of house engineering and whatnot. When did you start to take on some of that additional stuff? I know you mentioned early on
necessity. I can't even say that because like I know some of the biggest acts in the world have people wearing two hats for the job. But typically, like you think about somebody like, I don't know, like Pink or Lady Gaga, like they don't have somebody who's a front of house engineer and a tour manager. You know, that's next level stuff. But when you're a smaller band or like a smaller tour, say a one bus tour, they need a tour manager. They know they need a front of house engineer and they know they have the budget for one. So they call you and they go, "Hey man, I got this great opportunity for you to do two jobs for the price of one." And then of course, you know, I have to come back. "Well, that's cool. I'm willing to do two jobs for the price of one and a half." And then, you know, that goes in, but it all came down to necessity and money. And it's a good stepping stone to see. I know a handful of people who that's how they've determined their career path. And some go both ways. It's like, "Oh, do I like to do the tour managing and the front of house thing? I'd rather just be an engineer." Or, "You know what? I'm actually really good at being the director and I want to stick with the management side of things." And I have a couple of friends who were both audio and TM or PM, and they went to the management side of things.
Looking back to like your 18-year-old self, was the world even more grandiose, or was it like when you got under the hood, you were like, "This is how it works"?
You know, it's fine on the surface. And there was a part of me that was like, "Man, I'm going on tour, man." And it was,
yeah.
But honestly, when I first went on tour, I was already married.
Mm.
And in fact, that was delayed. My first tour offer was in 2005 or six, I don't remember which, and it was for a USO tour, and I was so excited. I remember I got this, like, I'm going on tour, and I go and I tell my wife I'm going on tour, and she's like, "Cool, where are you going?" Because she was really supportive, and I said, "We're going to Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Afghanistan and all these stands," and she burst into tears. I'm like, whoa, what's wrong? And that was also at the same time where journalists were getting kidnapped and beheaded by terrorists,
right,
in all those same countries. So I very respectfully called the guy back and said, I can't do your tour. And it was a couple more years before I had been offered that. So I legit missed the opportunity for being excited to go on tour because I had to turn it down. And then I went back to the work of getting good at what I do and really honing that skill set. So by the time that tour offer came, my tour was working for the company and not the artist. So I had it in my head. You know, I was raised right. So, you know, if somebody's putting me to work, I'm not going to party it up. I'm going to represent my employer well. I'm going to represent myself well. So I never kind of fell into that on tour trap, or mentality. But honestly, after sitting home for 18 months and doing I started with my partner, I started a company doing live stream production because we had nothing else to do in a pandemic. But I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm like really excited for August 24th.
Right. Very cool. Yeah, right. Do you want to touch on that company all started?
Oh, I'd love to. Look at the background. See?
Yeah. Hello.
Oh, and again, this is an audio podcast, so nobody has any clue of the stupid limbo I just did on my virtual background. I would love to talk about Hello Productions. Yeah. Hello TV. March 14th, give or take. Yeah. Like everything stopped. The whole world quit. And it took maybe a month, and I had been watching the industry kind of fall. I had been prepping. I was going to go out. I was going to have a record year. It's going to be like 200 and some dates.
Wow.
And I was actually going to probably have the best year financially I had ever had. And of course that all changed. So I'm watching our industry fall apart. And at some point it was this special on TV to raise money for something COVID related. It was like the first thing in April, and it was Lady Gaga and Elton John, and it was like a telethon, and it was all people playing at home through GoPros, and the audio was mediocre at best. The video quality was complete awfulness. Yeah, I can say, like these people need to know it was bad.
Right.
And I called Paris, she's our videographer and photographer for Godsmack. So we had met on the Godsmack tour, and we were in this group that plays Call of Duty together.
Nice.
So I'm not kidding. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm playing Call of Duty in the middle of a pandemic, because what else do I have to do?
Right.
And hey, did any of you guys see that Lady Gaga telethon thing? And she was like, no, why? It was bad. And she's like, well, what's your point? I was like, we can do better. And that was how it started. Was like, okay, what are you talking about? We can do better. I'm like, well, I'm an audio engineer. You're a videographer. Like, your content is phenomenal. Like, I think I'm pretty good. I know a bunch of people. So I started making some phone calls, and I got all the gear and all the space donated for a year for us to bring bands into our studio to create live stream videos, but they weren't live. Like we pre-recorded and edited them. It was more like a music video than a live show. And we marketed it as live, and it was still new content to whoever was watching it. But these bands that didn't have any opportunity, they hadn't played together in months. They hadn't rehearsed together in months. Like, we gave them a stage, and it wasn't your basement with a GoPro. Like, we built an arena stage with lights and, you know, the same audio setup that I'm using on tour. So it was a complete well-produced pro show. And we did, I think all in all, we did 40 last year. Between the 1st of June and the end of the year, we did 40 shows. 35 of them were free. So like our first idea was we'd get sponsorship. And we did. We got some great sponsorship. We got, of course, all of the sound and lights and video and our staging, microphones, everything was donated. So there's a financial benefit to not having to pay for stuff, but I still couldn't, you know, pay myself. And then we got George Dickel whiskey, and George Dickel whiskey wasn't really into giving us money, but they gave me like 4 cases of high-end bourbon, which turned into my thank you gifts for all the other vendors around Christmas time. Like, hey, here's a nice bottle of, like, you know, the Blue Label rye, have at it. You know, so we got a coffee company that they sent us a bunch of coffee for the dressing room. So it turned out to be a bunch of trading content for content. But while we weren't a big company, we're just, you know, two people that brought in a bunch of friends to do this thing. And we're kind of figuring out how to be a media presence while trying to figure out how to make live stream videos, while still trying to figure out how to maintain our careers as a videographer, a photographer, and an audio engineer moving forward.
Right.
So we focused on creating the best content and just like, no, we're just going to give this away and see what bites. And it finally had gotten to a point where we weren't really soliciting any work. People were coming to us like, oh, wait, you're doing this for free? Like, yeah, we're doing this for free. And we didn't, our idea was to raise money for Music Cares and industry charities. And we were able to donate enough back in. Like, I got a check from Music Cares and I think she did too. We were able to donate enough back in. So we're like, even, you know, like paid back the charity we received. But it had become like, looking around in an industry full of people not working or had left the industry altogether to go to like real jobs with, you know, healthcare and stuff, or that were just sitting around doing nothing and complaining the whole time. There was 11 of us that were doing something and staying relevant or learning new skills and developing new skills or maintaining relationships. And that, I mean, there's a reason that I believe that there's a reason that everybody that was working with Hello when the pandemic started or when we started doing this, they all have jobs right now. Well, we're going to find out. We actually have a couple of shoots scheduled for Hello like recording while I'm on tour with Avatar. And that's cool. I was talking with somebody about the audio today, and I have a handful of people that I know and trust. And the other thing is we've built these relationships. So we will get the crew necessary to do the show, and it will be the same quality of the show. But Hello is... it's not just a live stream company. Hello is just production. Like it's creative music, live music production, and it's just me and Paris. So conveniently enough, Paris is coming out on Avatar with me as our photographer, videographer as well. So Hello is now, like, since it's just our company, Hello is now the photographer in front of house engineer for Avatar. Hello is now doing that. So we're just... whatever it is we are just this creative entity within the live music space.
That's awesome. Well, I'm excited to see where that goes. That's a very inspiring origin story, and I have no doubt that that's going to continue to skyrocket. I think especially with what we realized as a collective species, if you will, was how far behind I think we really were as far as like a lot of those services are concerned. Like you mentioned, I mean, those were some of the biggest names in the world that you didn't have a good live stream, especially with a band like Avatar. That's so theatrical. That's going to be really cool to see.
I'm really excited for it because, I mean, I didn't know much about Avatar, and I get the call to do this thing. Of course, I look it up. And I was talking with another friend of mine about how he chooses tours. And he's next level, but he lets his, he plays it back for his kids. Like, what do you think? And does that, so I did the same thing. I actually had three different tours presented for me like this fall. And I sent links to YouTube videos of each of the artists to my daughter. I'm like, what do you think? And she's like, that Avatar band's kind of cool. I'm like, all right. See what that, let's see what goes with that. And then watching the live stream that they did last year was some amazing stuff. It was completely different style than what we do with Hello. Cause if you've seen any of the Hello videos, go to Hello, HELLOOOTV.com. You can see a link to all of our videos. Ours have this really organic feel. It's a second person point of view where, It puts the viewer like you're in the front row at a show. Like you want that perspective, and the audio mix is 3D and immersive. And the way Avatars did theirs was much more theatrical. The cameras were back. You could see the whole stage. It was third person. It wasn't immersive. It was observant. Mm-hmm. But what they did with lights and set and motion was just, it was some more of that next level stuff. It was, I noticed there was companies like Hello. A friend of mine down here in Florida was doing some. Avatar did theirs, but they did theirs in Sweden, of course, that were really focused on creating new ways for fans to experience music. Mm-hmm. If you got to see the Billie Eilish live stream, that was cool. Cause that was,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like she got eaten by a shark in her own. It was silly. Cool. And it didn't look cheesy. It was cool. And it was just something way different. And I saw some artists, some huge artists kind of phoning it in. It was like, okay, we're going to set up in this place. We're just going to play the same arena show we've played for 10 or 15 years. And we're just going to use the same cameras and angles that we used in the arenas on like the IMAG screens at the arenas. It's like, and it doesn't matter for them. The act is so big, like their mega hit.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Like people just want to hear that mega hit or all 100 of those mega hits, but the creative element is gone. Like you look at this, we learned early on, you don't have to have a live show. Once we started talking to these bands about it, like, you don't need to be live. The audience isn't there. So no matter how live you think it is, they're already out. You know, it doesn't matter. And so what? Like they don't have to spend $15 on a fridge. They don't have to wait in line at their own house to go to the bathroom. This is good. So now you can take this medium and make it new and amazing. Like it doesn't have to be just, you know, the band guys at the end of the room. Like you could play in the round. You could be immersive. Everybody could have their own camera. Like you can get yourself eaten by a shark. There's literally no limit to what we can do with technology if you actually put it to good use and put some thought behind it.
Definitely. Oh, I love it. I'm excited. I watched some of the videos that your guy like online. I'll have to keep my eyes peeled too. I watched with Smith and Myers. Yeah. Yep. I really like that one. Yeah, like you said, just like that right up there where they were seeing like the camera like going around them kind of thing. I thought was really sweet.
Oh, well, okay. If you watched all of our videos, there's one like we talked earlier about signatures or whatever. There's a video signature in every show.
Oh, okay.
Where there's one, it just look for it. And what it is, there's a shot that Paris will do where she never stops moving. The camera is always focused on the subject and she'll do a 360 degree around that subject, but it's in her hand. It's not on a track. It's not on a gimbal, anything like that. Everything they shot was handheld. So, and it was funny. She did that one. And I remember it, she did it in like the first show. I was like, what is that? That's like cool. And she's like, I don't know. I felt like doing it. And it was like, no, it was really cool. And she did it. It's in every show.
Wow. Folks, if you go to their site, there's actually literally her holding the top banner. They're holding the cameras up. And so it literally is just that. It's just the strap and she's just holding it. And she kept it that airtight. Wow.
Oh yeah, if you want to hear some funny behind the scenes stuff, is we record the shows as a live show. Mm-hmm. We tell the bands like, in order to keep it live as much as possible, don't stop. Mm. Like if you screw up, if you make a mistake, if you want to change something, let's do it at the end. And well, that particular Smith and Myers show, those guys hadn't played those songs together in the same room ever. Oh, like wow. They had recorded that album individually during the pandemic. They did we also would make the artists go through a complete rehearsal of the show so they got more comfortable playing. So they did a complete rehearsal of the show where they were learning the songs and we filmed the rehearsal and then they did the show. So for this 45 minute show, we're at like 5 or 6 hours in and all three of the girls are got their cameras right here in their hand and they're like, their arms are getting tired.
Right.
And the show's done and like, is everything good? Everything good? And I come over, talk back like, hey man, can we redo something? And everybody in there was like, no, it's fine.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
We recorded that on the 5th of July last year. It was in our studio was in a warehouse, not air conditioned.
Oh.
And I turned off all the exhaust fans because they make noise.
Mm-hmm. Oh man.
So everybody is just drenched in sweat. They're miserable. My studio's air conditioned, so I'm like, I'm not thinking that, you know, I've got a monitor guy, a stage manager, two assistants, three camera people, and two artists on stage who probably sweated off 5 pounds each.
Right.
And I'm just the complete butthead. It's like, yeah, guys, can we redo something? And we have a policy of we don't do any punch-ins. Like, it's not because we can't do any punch-ins. It's because we want to keep that organic live feel to it. And I literally, like, there was one weird note on one piece of one bit of guitar in one song. And it was like, can't you punch it in? And I opened my mouth to say, like, you know, we don't do punch-ins. And I'm like, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah. That's awesome. And yeah, I guess I got some rapid fire questions for you, just an either or kind of situation. So if you had to choose tour management or production management?
Can I choose audio? can I choose front of house?
I figured that would be too easy.
Tour management or production management? Honestly, I would take tour management.
Right on. Arena shows or outdoor festival shows?
Outdoor festival.
Would you prefer to engineer a rave or a gospel revival set?
Gospel revival.
Awesome. And do you prefer touring East Coast or West Coast?
East Coast for sure.
Closer together.
I know these are rapid fire questions, but there's so much to do on the East Coast. On the West Coast, all you do is sit and wait for the road to go by.
Why do you want to work in music, or why do you work in music?
So I don't have any other marketable skills.
That's fair.
I don't know, man. I've never been asked that specific question before. I wasn't listless. It's not like I didn't have any direction, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. And out of high school, I did some college, and then I worked for a company. I was an IT guy back in the Novell NetWare and Windows NT days. That sounds like one of those YouTube videos where kids look up like old technology and go, what the hell is this? But I was like, nothing jived for me. Nothing moved me. I was like, I for real thought I would go through life just being one of those people who went to a job that he hated, but, you know, made enough money to live for the weekend. I thought that was my lot in life. That's kind of how I was raised. It was like, you grow up, you get a job, you work, you know, you take your family on vacation for 2 weeks in the summertime, but the other 50 weeks of your life kind of sucks.
Right.
And then I met my now ex-wife, who's still a very dear friend of mine, but she had introduced me to a local band. Because I was actually dating a friend of hers, and they introduced me to this local band, and I wasn't doing anything in the music business. I kind of wanted to play in a band, and I'm a shitty guitar player. And they're like, oh, you should go meet these guys. You should meet this guy, Jim, and he'll, you'll like him. And it turns out that he and I were like long lost twin brothers, and he was the drummer for the band. And he was like, why don't you come work for us? And that was how it started. It was like, I didn't know what I was getting into. I just knew that I had something to do on a Friday night and hang out with some cool people.
And I guess conversely, what do you hope the people around you get out of collaborating in this like music realm?
Depends on who I'm collaborating. Like, well, collectively, it doesn't matter. I just want to have I want to be the best and have and offer the best. But say, with something like Hello, what I want out of the collaboration is I want everybody to grow. Like I want what we're creating to help the artist to grow. And at the same time, I want Hello to grow. If I'm, you know, on tour this summer and I'm mixing Avatar, I want the audience to be able to walk away having, you know, the most amazing, unique experience of their life. I mean, and it's because you never know who's in the audience. You never know what somebody's particular life circumstance is, right? So they might just be out there having a good time on a Wednesday night. They might be celebrating, you know, their final day in chemo. They might have just lost everything and decided, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to go to the rock show. You know, they could have gotten the biggest promotion. They could have gotten proposed to. Like, you never know. But for whatever reason, they're there in that space. And I want that audience to remember that night, that moment, whatever it is. And I'd like it to be for good reasons and not looking at the front of house console going, why is this guy?
Yeah, that's fair. And then before I let you go, I guess if you were to rewind to right before that future long lost twin of yours rolls through, what would you say to yourself?
Oh, like I guess before I had met all these people and started down this journey.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. What would I say to myself? Get your shit together, dude. it didn't matter. Like I could have been a teacher. I could have been anything. I didn't really know. I had a lot of like, maybe I'll try this, maybe I'll try that, but nothing really stuck. But I would maybe that's it. Maybe like follow your passion, because, and that sounds cliche, right? Like everybody talks about that, but I can think back, and I've never thought about this until just now. Like I can look back and go, you know, nothing was clicking for me until I started doing what I love to do, but I didn't know I loved to do this until I started doing it.
That's awesome. I'm so thankful you took this time, and I know it's much later over by you, but.
It's all good, man. Thank you. I had a great time.
Yeah, likewise, and might have to do it again sometime.
I would be my pleasure. I would love to.
Cheers. Huge thank you again to Eric for taking time to be on Made for Music. He has a lot of amazing projects going on right now. Again, be sure to go check out Hello TV as well. Be sure to catch him on the road with Avatar. The US leg kicks off Wednesday, September 1st in Albany, New York, and makes it really all the way around the country. So be sure to tap in. And if you dig what you hear, please be sure to rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Genuinely appreciate that extra effort, and I will see you next time.